You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
This episode is sponsored by Blue Chew. Guys, remember the days when you were always ready to go? Look, I take a step back sometimes and I realize, yo, I'm in my mid-30s. A lot of the guests on this podcast are men of a certain age. We're not spring chickens, but the only way to get your 10,000 hours in is with time. So I thought I should let you guys know, especially through these hard times during a pandemic, that you can now increase your performance and get that extra confidence in bed. Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach, which I certainly can't have sex on a full stomach, but it's cool that it's an option, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises, if you're a big stud like that. If you could benefit from more confidence where it counts, Blue Chew is the fast and easy way to enhance your performance. Blue Chew is prescribed online by licensed physicians, so you don't have to go to the doctor's office or wait in line at the pharmacy, and it ships right to your door in a discreet package. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy, and, no awkwardness. You don't even have to leave your house. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use my special promo code, Beethoven. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code Beethoven, to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper choice, and we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you help make this podcast possible. So please be sure to use our promo code Beethoven at BlueChew.com.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
Greetings, Earthlings. Allow me to present to you episode 104 of the podcast. Follow me as I'm fresh on the heels of a van, speeding down the highway towards the next record store where creativity and passion await, and which I boldly go where no man has gone before.
I am left with only one hypothesis, that we are being visited by a being of pure sound.
My guest this week is...
My name is Dixon Hill. I make hip-hop beats, and I've worked with Guilty Simpson, Kool G Rap, Lil Fame of MLP. I got some other stuff in the can with OC, working on some stuff with AG of DITC, and working on some stuff with Novelist from Clear Soul Forces as well.
You see, the deep space beam is useless, all channels. All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce. It could conceivably drive everyone on board permanently deaf, not stop.
Holodecks were depicted in a number of ways on the Star Trek series, in simulating settings and significant events, endeavors in science, logistics, and law were portrayed. A diverse variety of settings and situations have been depicted on the holodeck, including the American Wild West and the adventures of Captain Jean-Luc Picard playing the role of Dixon Hill. Not familiar with Dixon Hill? A fictional 20th century detective, except Patrick Stewart ain't here, and the Reading Rainbow guy certainly isn't here. It is, in fact, Dixon Hill, but instead of solving crimes, we're solving the story behind the beats and motivations as a producer. Thank you for being here. If you haven't already visited the website, bedroombeethovens.com, what are you doing, man? Everything is there, from past episodes, to buying a t-shirt, to donating to the Patreon. That's right, Earthlings. A buck or two is what I ask of you, to buy in what I'm doing, to support a creative, and in turn I load you up with content and goodies. Week after week I provide the 10,000 hour journey to you, and I'm not stopping anytime soon, so take the ride with me. I hope everyone is staying safe out there. I'm happy to talk wrestling, Star Trek, and of course music with the great and powerful Dixon Hill. Enjoy.
I am left with only one hypothesis, that we are being visited by a being of pure sound.
So how are you living, man? It's a new year. You got a new tape out. Are you feeling good?
I am feeling good. I actually am coming off of a fresh weekend of celebrating the instrumental release. So I had a friend come visit. We're actually moving out of our apartment. There's just a lot of stuff going on. So we kind of cut loose this weekend and allowed ourselves to have a good time just because this whole year has been head down working, you know? So it's kind of nice to take a breather.
Well, let me drill down. Did you have a good breakfast this morning as well?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm a big breakfast guy.
That's good. That means that you're in a pretty good mood. So right off the bat, I feel I got to be honest with you because the holodeck and Dixon Hill is all trapped in the Star Trek world. And I'm not a Star Trek guy, man. I'm sorry.
The name and the inspiration behind it, it's obviously very important to me. But at the end of the day, it's always been about the music and how people can identify with it. So I have made attempts to sort of make it, you know, universally understandable or universally enjoyable, like whether or not you care for some of the source material, you know?
Yeah, well, even the J.J. Abrams movies, that, and they tried to make it more flashy, I still... Unfortunately, I couldn't get on board, but
totally cool.
However, I will say that regarding Dixon Hill, I looked at some scenes and there was a scene in First Contact where they said, "What's shaking, Dix?" And he said, "The usual, Nick, martinis and skirts." And I thought that was like the dopest line ever.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite movies in the whole pantheon. So yeah, I mean, I can talk Trek all day, but I've had you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. And I've had experiences where, you know, you don't have to defend your fandom and you also don't have to judge anybody for their opinions either, you know?
That's true. But if I want to know more about the man behind the music, I am curious to know why it resonates with you so much.
Yeah. Well, I guess the main reason why I chose the name is when I was working on music, when it was just sort of a hobby and I was moving into the space where I thought I would try to make it more than a hobby, there's that dreaded moment where you have to say, okay, how are you going to brand yourself? What is your name going to be? When you think about it, you come across a lot of, I guess in the typical pantheon of, or the lexicon of hip hop, you can come up with some pretty corny names that just didn't really fit my personality or what I was going for. And as far as Star Trek and Dixon Hill and the holodeck, the idea is that the holodeck is an escape for Captain Picard. He can be anything he wants to be. And when I'm working on music, I can sample any genre. I can explore any musical idea. And I can sort of take on the personality or the emotion of that music. And I don't have to think about it. So that's sort of a high-level version of why I chose the name.
So the Dixon character was a detective, and if I think of detective greats, you got Marlowe, Magnum PI, Sherlock Holmes. Why hasn't Dixon received his due?
I think, you know, Star Trek.
Where do I start? Do I start with the big goodbye or the Black Orchid or the Long Dark Tunnel? If I want to know more about Dixon, where do I start?
You just got to watch Star Trek. I mean, it's
there's no way around it.
It's not like Sherlock Holmes where you can go and explore that yourself, or like, because Star Trek has a lot of literary references in it that are quite rewarding to explore, right? Like, one of the reasons I read Moby Dick was because of Star Trek. One of the reasons I started reading Sherlock Holmes when I was a kid was because of Star Trek. So it's like, if you take a look at a TV show that was on prime time and kind of campy, it was still exploring very interesting philosophical ideas and introducing people, whether they wanted to explore it more or not, to some pretty lofty stuff and rewarding, you know, pieces of culture and history.
Did you know that the theme of Star Trek actually has roots in jazz music?
That's pretty cool. What fact do you have for me there?
So the guy who composed the theme song, he explained that his inspiration for the main part of the theme is from Beyond the Blue Horizon. which is a pop tune from the 1930s, and it also shares a harmonic progression with the jazz standard Out of Nowhere, which was Bing Crosby's first number one hit. And you can definitely hear the melodic similarity in Bing's original version, but when Charlie Parker and Miles Davis slowed it down and made a ballad out of the tune, I'm hearing that the resemblance is like downright eerie.
Yeah. Well, that's not a dot that I've connected. So thank you for that. I'm about to go dive in.
Yeah, and then, I haven't watched much Star Trek, but then when you drill down from there, here's what I connected to that. So Next Generation writers send Commander Riker to a holodeck jazz club to unwind, and Riker complained that he could never master a fictional standard called Nightbird. So I'm starting to see, like, even the writers love jazz, and Deep Space Nine crew, they also like to hang out in holodeck bars. Their favorite hologram was lounge singer Vic Fontaine.
Vic Fontaine, oh yeah.
Lieutenant Harry Kim led a jazz quartet on Voyager called the Kim Tones.
Yep.
And on Star Trek Enterprise, we learned that free jazz has an interesting effect on the Vulcan psyche. So music and Star Trek, match made in heaven, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, it was the right time for it. And Gene Roddenberry was drawing inspiration from everything. So you can hear it. The references are there. I mean, like, the Data was programmed to play violin just like all the greats and synthesize all these great players. So if you want to know who Heifetz is, you've never listened to classical, you might dig into it because you saw Data on Star Trek playing violin.
Yeah, that stuff's so cool. And I know I listened to the holodeck tape, and I know you have like some samples and everything, but I thought it was really cool that you could go to a website like Cameo and you can buy actors from Star Trek Generation, Discovery, and you can have like a different actor like opening up a track saying whatever you want, except Jeri Ryan. She wants like 8 times more than what everyone else is charging. I don't understand that, but.
I can't comment on that, but if she's got to make her money, that's cool.
So did you get a chance to actually meet Patrick Stewart at a Comic-Con?
No, I haven't, but that would be a moment. I've met a lot of my idols, actually. I've been pretty lucky, but that would be one of those ones where I think I would still get starstruck. You turn into a bumbling fool, you kind of get really nervous and you sort of fall into your shell of being like an excited kid again. I would definitely feel that way meeting Patrick Stewart.
So what's the motivation to pack up a studio, get in a van and hit the road?
A lot of it is circumstance. I mean, the whole introduction to that lifestyle was sort of an accident. I was in a strange living situation out in Colorado. I used to hang out with these climbers, and they would do this thing called dirt bagging, where when they couldn't find an apartment or something like that, they would camp up in their pickup truck, or they would camp out in a van and just kind of live life that way. So being introduced so casually to that idea, I got bounced from a place I was living in. It was weird. I was kind of down on my luck, and I found a painter's van on Craigslist and just went for it. And I started dirt bagging. My buddy had some connects working film festivals, so I didn't need to live anywhere. I just started driving around and getting jobs at film festivals, doing production, building stages, doing sound, whatever. And in that time, I sort of was like, okay, I can get a, I was kind of dabbling in music when that started. And I had a little portable generator and I could set up a portable turntable, and I realized with the SP, I could start taking samples. And then, you know, nowadays you can do a lot of stuff in the laptop. So you can get a tremendous amount of arranging and demos done completely on the road, which was exciting too, because it exposed me to tons of different record stores in my travels. And it actually made digging almost easier, just because you're not going to the same place every week. And because once you pick a place dry, it takes a while for them to come up with stuff that's interesting. I got lucky. And the fun thing about making music on the road is that I can now, I sort of have this historical record of places that I've been when I listen to the music. So a horn will come in on a beat and I'll be like, yeah, I remember I bought that in Montana, or I discovered that when I was on the beach here listening to records. And it's very, very, it's fun for me because it's like a trip down memory lane when I'm listening to the music.
That's cool. I thought you bought the van for the purpose of having a mobile studio. So that's kind of cool.
No.
And this van got stolen at one point.
Yeah, it did. That's the short version of the story. So I had a deep fryer in the back of that van because I was I had just left a friend's house. We had a barbecue and I made churros for the first time and they were excellent. I was so happy with myself. So I'm like, yeah, okay, but I had to clean it. So I just left it in there that night. And then I had two wrestling action figures, a Hacksaw Jim Duggan and a King Kong Bundy. This is all going to be relevant later, but the van got stolen that night. So the next morning, I started going around to pawn shops. I started going around to every used toy store in town, seeing, did anybody try to sell you a deep fryer? Anybody try to sell you a Hacksaw Jim Duggan or a King Kong Bundy action figure? And I actually found a couple of leads going to these stores. They're like, yeah, somebody came in a couple of weeks ago selling these LGN figures. And I was like playing detective myself for a couple of weeks. Of course, I reported it to the police and they tried to help me, but eventually the van was recovered and it was in shambles. It was essentially being used as a crack house. And I had lived in that thing on and off for so many years. And there were so many memories in that thing that I went to the impound lot where it was and started digging through stuff to find what was salvageable. I had to put on a respirator. I had to put on gloves. There was like needles, butane torches, spoons. It was nasty. But I was able to get a lot of sentimental gear back. I was able to find a lot of good souvenirs from the road and salvage some stuff. But then after seeing the state of the van, I was like, you know what? Good riddance. But now I'm back in the process of building a new mobile death machine.
The van's gone? Oh, no.
Yeah, the van's gone. Because what I learned a fun fact. This you might know this. Who knows? But if somebody in Nevada, if somebody does Schedule I drugs in your car, it's effectively totaled.
I thought it goes to like police auction and you can buy it for like $300. Like, oh, a family was murdered in the back, so we're gonna go to police auction.
Well, so the thing happens, like by the time they found it, my insurance had already paid out. So I was like, you know, screw it. I'm just gonna get another van that doesn't have crack residue in it.
That's probably a good idea.
Because this thing was nasty. Because, I mean, it was built out to live in. So there was a mattress. There was who knows what this person was doing in there. I mean, I could tell you other stuff I found in there, but you could probably guess.
Person or people?
There was evidence of people. I'm not going to say I'm a crack detective, but there was definitely evidence of, special relationships going on there. I think the oldest profession was getting more money than I was at that time in the van.
I ask you because you said if you found it, you were prepared to handle this man to man. You wouldn't need police. So are we talking fisticuffs or you would have given him some verbal truths? How would you have handled that?
Oh, I was pretty angry. So I probably would have punched the guy in the face. I guess I'm a pretty big dude. I'm 6'6", 250. And I don't know. I've seen my fair share of scraps in the day, and I've had to defend myself in the van before. Just living in the van, you just run into shit. People try to break into it, this and that and the third. So I've had to stand my ground before. And like it was such a violation to get the van stolen that if I had discovered the person, I probably would have been angry enough to commit an act of violence. I'm not necessarily proud of that, but I definitely was not happy.
Almost a blessing in disguise, though, because they were so fixated on getting their next hit that they didn't steal your family heirlooms. They didn't steal your recording equipment. You know, they were just – they had tunnel focus on their own selfish desires that you were able to recoup some of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really lose anything incredibly valuable. And the big thing was the sentimental stuff, which it has no value to anyone but me. So – it's just cheap little crap, but like it just has a lot of tremendous emotional attachment to it.
Were you living in Vegas when this incident happened?
Yeah.
So were you questioning if Vegas was maybe the right energy for you? Like, man, should I even be here? Is this a sign?
Oh yeah. Cause we had been bouncing around for a while, and this was the first place we decided to settle. And, you know, it was like the first month we were here, the van got stolen. It's just like, okay, this is not a good starting point. And first impressions are everything, but we like it out here. It has a lot to offer us, and, you know, shit happens.
But but that wasn't the only incident. Like, you would be sleeping and people would be trying to break in.
So I was working the LA Film Festival, and yeah, just, I think there was like a point in 1 week, two different people tried to break in. And the funny part about it actually was that's, you know, you kind of learn. I was a little bit novice at the time. So, and it was hot. It was super, super hot. It was the middle of the summer. So I was sleeping in my underwear, and then somebody would try to break in, and I'd have to jump out the van in my underwear and then be like, hey, like, let's, what's going on? You know? So I think people got, it was great, like, seeing the reactions of people, because these guys are just like, hey, you know, I'm going to see if there's any tools in this van or something. And then a huge half naked dude jumps out ready to kill him. I'm not sure they were expecting that.
I got to let people know that this isn't like a piece of shit van. It's a commercial Ford Transit vehicle. Like, why is it such a magnet for scumbags?
I think people, a big thing, well, actually, I learned from the police that it's one of the most stolen vans of 2019. Just because Ford made it commercially available in the United States in much larger numbers recently. And most of the time, people think they can steal high-value tools, because 99% of the time, these are work vans. And people got some good stuff back there. So most of the time people think, oh, I'll bust a window, I'll grab some power tools, and then go pawn them.
I mean, or why don't they just put windows in the back? And then people would have saw that there's no tools in there.
Well, I mean, the issue with that is that if you are using it to camp, you need your privacy. So covering up windows, insulation, that's all really important, because you don't want to get hassled. Because, you know, you're living a vagrant life, and there's people that don't take too kindly to that, and that there's other pitfalls, even though you're just somebody minding your own business.
Well, what's also cool is they didn't even steal the vinyl that was in there, which there is a lot of great stuff to say about the project with you and Guilty Simpson. But let me just say and give you credit that this might be the first time where a person's project, when you look at the cover art, his name is smaller than the featured guest. So Guilty Simpson's name is about 8 times bigger than yours. And like, you can say, oh, it's marketing. More people know Guilty's name than mine, so it'll sell better. But I think that's a cop-out. I think that you have a good ego, and it shows your humility.
I mean, he brought the project to life. He's the main guy. Like, I've always believed in producer-MC duos. I mean, I'm obviously a Gangstar fan. Pete Rock and CL Smooth. Cool G Rap and DJ Polo. I just like the duos, but when it comes down to it, the person that's putting it to life and bringing it to life is the MC. So I wanted to give him his due. And also, you know, there is a little bit of consideration as far as just balance and layout. Putting both of our names really big didn't necessarily work for me, just given the shape on the front. And I didn't want to put my name above his, because my name is shorter when it comes to typeface. The way, as you can see on the cover, the way it's laid out, it would look weird if I had my name under his, because his is longer. So I was just like, oh, I'm not going to put mine on top. So I did the little nod. And if people want to dig in, because, I mean, I guess I'm old school. When I hear something I like, I hear a beat I like, I figured out who did it. I look at the liner notes. I do what I can. So I hope that people do that. But at the end of the day, he's the one that brought it to life. I want his name on there nice and big, because he did great work. And I got nothing but good things to say about that whole recording experience.
So if you guys make another album, you guys got to come up with a name for yourselves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe. That'd be fun.
Well, this van, the Guilty record was made in, obviously. So, but let's talk about promoting this album door-to-door to independent record stores. So let's say I'm in Osaka, Japan, and I have a record store called Cello's Records, and you walk in, you slap some vinyl on the counter. What's your sales pitch?
My sales pitch, it changed every time, because you never know who you're going to get behind the counter. Sometimes you got people that just don't know hip hop behind the counter. I don't know. I mean, I had a one sheet, and I would just give it to people, be like, hey, this is my record. Here's the price for you. And here's a one sheet. And if they had any other questions, I would talk to them about it. But if I got the vibe that it was a hip hop store, I'd be like, hey, me and Guilty Simpson made a record together. It's hardcore hip hop. some good old boom bap and Cool G rapping, Lil Famous on it.
Glad I don't let them run me. You can't afford your habit, you a junkie. That's what the people say. I should spit on you, but you ain't worth the DNA.
And it's just like, for a hip-hop dude, that was always a go. Everybody's like, yeah, we'll buy one from you. It's not a big deal. I'm not asking a lot. But the way that I do what I do is because of independent record stores. The reason why I am a musician is because I grew up in record stores. I would save my lunch money from school and I wouldn't eat so I could go to a record store.
You and the whole team get hit for speaking on the realest breathing. Really, you should be pleading the fifth. Was revenge on you clowns with wins. Turn the corner on them, then double round again. Right. Talking down on me will not elevate your status. Self, it just shows you maggots. Flies love shit, so they started. But I've never ever been an easy target. I hit back and protect my own. My right mind is left alone.
So when it comes down to it, making relationships with those tastemakers, the people that are going to recommend your record because they saw you or they had a good interaction with you, to me that means a lot. Because the people that are still going to record stores and buying vinyl, those are the fans that, in my mind, tend to become more dedicated than somebody who maybe just came across your beat tape or your album on Spotify on like a recommended playlist or something. So I found a lot of value in just going door to door, where sometimes, yeah, they wouldn't buy the record, but they would just remember who I was. But most of the time, the reaction was positive. People were sort of surprised that I was doing it. And in some cases, I mean, I still have relationships with some of these record stores that we really had a good time. We chopped it up and they supported the record. And they said, hey, anytime you have something else, you know, let's do it. You know, you just kind of make that interaction and it's good.
Digging since you were little, a casual I think would flip through records and they would come across like Minnie Riperton in the Dollar Bin and just go over it. But you're a hip-hop fan, so you know, if you're a hip-hop fan, you gotta by default, you gotta be a Minnie fan.
I actually have a couple beats that I made from a Minnie Riperton record, In My Garden Property, you know that one. But, you know, sometimes just stuff doesn't make it, and it doesn't make it on tapes. And I also, something I'm wary of is whether or not a sample has been used before. And I'm not a stickler about like, oh, nobody's allowed to use it, or just because so-and-so already used it, I shouldn't do it. But I will kind of test myself, like, can I do better? Like, am I ever going to flip this better than Q-Tip did? So a lot of times when it is like a very popular hip-hop record, I'll pick it up and I'll see if I can flip it. But a lot of the time I'm just like, you know, it's not lyrics to go. Let me see if I can find something maybe more obscure or something that people haven't explored yet.
Yeah, I think there was a guy on House Shoes' label called Juicy the Emissary who flipped like Kmart radio samples from like the 70s. And you don't have to worry about anyone in that territory. The same way you parsed hundreds of hours of courtroom audio, you probably don't have to worry about people flipping verdict announcements and cross examinations. So, you know, I think that's pretty innovative.
Well, I like this kind of trend in hip hop where people, they name their albums like a play on words based on the artist's name. And I'm thinking, okay, Guilty Simpson. I didn't want to do something obvious like, oh, Guilty Conscience or Guilty as Charged, you know, something goofy like that.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because there would be an album that's called that, right? So I was just getting a little bit in the weeds as far as legal jargon came across and law Latin. My philosophy background just kind of had me searching for Latin phrases. And Actus Reus came up. It means guilty act. It's the first constituent piece of figuring out whether or not somebody should be guilty of a crime. And I was like, okay, Actus Reus, there we go. It opens it up for part two, mens rea, if we want to do it. And then how am I going to put this together? Publicly available records of, yeah, every Supreme Court case ever. So if you listen to that record, there's right in the beginning, it's Warren Berger, the legendary Warren Berger, talking about an actual case called Simpson v. the United States. And It had something to do with a robbery gone wrong. And then somewhere on there on Tap Jaws, it's Sotomayor in, what is it? Ilonas v. Florida? Ilonas v. the United States. It was a godsend when I found this case, because it's about a guy who wrote threatening rap lyrics on social media. And they were figuring out whether or not this was, you know, a true threat, whether or not this was actual threatening speech that should have been taken seriously.
It's kind of like that MF Doom song, right?
Like rap snitch knishes.
Rap snitch, yeah, there you go. Man,
yeah.
I think that's amazing, because I think the people who listen to that album, I think only like 1% or 2% would really get that. Man, moment of silence for that. I love that you put hundreds of hours of work into something that might go over the casual's head.
And that's fine. Like, one of the things that I try to strive for is like the product just has to be dope, right? You got to make something that casual hip hop fan wants to bob their head to, they're going to enjoy. But if they want to dig in, there's always going to be something more to look into.
Well, you mentioned you have a philosophy degree. You had a radio show in college. Why not just get a full blown music education?
I mean, I'm just kind of doing it piecemeal. I had a friend that went to Berkeley in Boston, and the formal music education, it has its benefits, but it has its pitfalls. I mean, it's school. You got to pay for it, right? And there's so much information available now online that if you take a base knowledge of music and you just start to supplement it with things, you can take yourself pretty far with, you know, self-teaching. Having a background, playing guitar, when a song calls for something, I'll start looking up how to modulate from this key to this key. And you start building your music theory knowledge over time based on necessity. And then the rabbit hole goes deeper and deeper, but you just find practical uses for it. And over years and years and years, I've sort of just built up a pretty decent practical knowledge of music. I'm not going to say like I'm a sight reader or like a master composer, but I can get it done and I can probably tell you what key it's in.
So how frustrating is it when you have this philosophy background, this music knowledge, you know that you're capable of making these amazing projects, but when you're making the Guilty Simpson record, you're just starting out. So you have to do these odd jobs, you know, that may or may not be related to your degree. It must be hard.
When you decide to get a philosophy degree, you're sort of opening up the door for having jobs that don't necessarily correlate. But I tell people, they go, well, what do you use that degree for? I tell them I use it every day. It helped me be a better critical thinker, a better writer, a better speaker. And you can apply that every single day to your life. So when I'm doing odd jobs, I mean, what it really did was it kept me from pigeonholing myself as far as what I could do or what I should do or what was expected of me. So I've worked a lot of different jobs. I mean, there was a little bit of time when I was delivering pizza. And at the same time, I was working at a craft brewery doing canning, and then doing the production work at film festivals. It was just like, any way to get the money, I get the money, because I know I'm funding what I really like to do. And the flexibility of the odd jobs allowed me to spend more time making music. So while it wasn't necessarily, you know, giving me a ton of money or directly applicable to my degree, so to speak, it certainly broadened my horizons and broadened my experience and allowed me to explore the stuff that I love. Because I've worked at tech companies before, and I've had pretty square office jobs, and your mind gets so taken over with the jargon of that job or the world of that job just to stay afloat that you start to forget stuff that you really care about. And it's hard to live in two worlds, be a full-time musician or be a full-time philosopher, writer, whatever, and then also be a salesman at a software company.
I hear that, but I blame John Cena. If he never existed, you could have had the whole wrestler musician thing, and Vince McMahon would have scooped you up. What are you, 6'5", 250? Yeah, come on, John Cena, you ruined it.
Yeah,
you ruined.
I mean, he's from New England. That's where I'm from. So we like John Cena. His rap album was interesting enough. It was funny. I mean, he worked with Premier. Freddie Fox is on that album.
Jake One and Eli and Sarface and Bumpy Knuckles, Big L. How did that happen?
Money. I don't know.
Jesus Christ,
dude. Cena's cool. I got nothing bad to say about Cena as a worker and as like a dude, but yeah, those days of him freestyle rapping were pretty goofy in my eyes.
Anything after the Attitude Era, you'll lose me. In fact, Undertaker was on Joe Rogan the other day, and it's surreal seeing him act like a human being. You know, I grew up thinking Kane was his actual brother. I bought in.
Oh yeah,
you know,
I thought he was the dead man. I thought he was a ghost for sure. Like the bell would toll, and I would be like, legit.
Yeah. Yeah. What was his manager? Paul Bearer. Yeah.
Paul Bearer.
Come on. That dude freaked me out too. So what was your training like? Was it more ECW backyard style or was it more structured?
It was structured from the get-go. I went to this place called FSW in Vegas. It's actually Jake the Snake's school. And there's some old school WWE guys there. D'Lo Brown as a teacher.
Man, D'Lo, he with the crazy head neck movement.
Yeah,
and he wore the bulletproof vest.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I haven't heard that name in like 15 years.
Yeah, well, he's helped a lot of people out in this area. And I mean, it started out for me just so I guess this also relates to music, because if I'm a fan of something and I find myself maybe critiquing it too much or, you know, kind of talking about it too much, I am just going to try it. I have to do it because I don't want to sit there and hate on something or have an opinion about something unless I know what it's like, unless I've really dived into it. So, you know, I've been a fan of wrestling my whole life. So I was like, there's a school in town. Hell yeah, I'm going to go. I want to learn. I want to take bumps. I want to see what it's like to be in the ring. And then, you know, you, of course, like peering behind the curtain in most cases just fills you with an even greater respect for what it is. And in my case, it made me a bigger fan. It made me a different fan, but it certainly made me appreciate a lot of the stuff that maybe went over my head or maybe just the average person doesn't really notice in that sport.
I bet. And you said something once that I love, like pertaining to music. A person will come out with an album and give this long-winded explanation on why it's profound and stuff, but no one can truly hear it in the music, even if they claim to. The music either speaks to people or it doesn't. So if I'm not a music producer. I don't understand how to use a beat machine. I don't understand time signatures. So it's unfair to say, hey, I listened to Holodeck 3. I didn't like it. You're right. It either speaks to people or it doesn't. It's one of the true art mediums where you don't fully have to understand it to appreciate it.
Yeah, and as a creator, you can't really beat yourself over the head trying to make people understand it. So if I have something to say through a beat, I mean, I'll make a beat and I'll feel something. I'll feel some kind of emotion about it. And maybe I'll add an interlude sample to set the tone, maybe. Like I'm maybe sort of trying to tune the person's brain, the listener's brain, to be in the mood that I'm in when I hear that beat. But you can't expect it. I mean, there's no accounting for taste and there's no accounting for how somebody interprets a sound and how somebody relates to disparate samples. But as long as you're making an honest statement, it's all good in my book.
Well, what else can we talk about with Holodeck 3? It was just released. Tell us a little bit about it.
It's my favorite beat tape. It took a while. It represents sort of a turning point in how I've been making music. I've sort of refined some of my sampling techniques and some of my arranging techniques and blended a lot of the stuff that I've learned through trial and error. And it also represents some level of, let's call it, practical stability in my trade, because I made about half of this record in a house with a roof over my head, which was like the lap of luxury. I had a desk. I mean, I was pretty happy.
I really appreciate you being here, man. I think your future is bright, and I wish you mega super success so you can have a whole fleet of vans someday, one for every day of the week. Van flossing.
That's great.
That's what I hope.
I'm with it, dude. Get it. And what I need is to get an artist around here to do some sick airbrush art, like a big, you know, dragon with like some dude shredding a guitar on the back of it, like some hardcore 80s shit, like some D&D shit with like a wizard shooting lightning bolts out of his fingers on the side of the van. That's my next goal. is to floss in like a total badass.
Yeah, you ain't
like
breaking into a van type with that shit on the side. You're gonna leave it alone.
No. You're in trouble. Yeah, run, you fools.